So as John said, you know, this is really a dialogue. So stop me at any time. I do have a few numbers I'm going to put up there, but it's mainly to remind me of things I want to tell you, and happy to stop and explain and go over it too. But this can be very, if I don't get to the end of my slides, that's fine, as long as we have some fun here today and try to understand young people. And the question that was posed by John is, can science help us overcome the dangers of risky adolescent decision making? And I probably that's the most important message that I'm carrying today, and that is the importance of science and evidence. You know, in psychology, a lot of people have opinions, especially about young people. We have myths that we believe in very, very deeply because that's what we were told, and everyone repeats them, and so they must be true. And I think it's so important, especially, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart, that journalists educate the public about what the evidence is, because a lot of human suffering occurs as a result of really not understanding what the facts are. We believe all kinds of things that aren't true, and it harms people. So I'm so glad you're here today, and you want to hear about, you know, the science behind adolescent risky decision making. So I'm going to really there's three parts to the presentation I'm going to make. I'm going to talk a little bit about the brain itself and how it changes massively between 5 and the early 20s. And that's really, really new research that has upended a lot of our assumptions about adolescent development. I'm going to talk a little bit about this theory that's evidence-based, this fuzzy trace theory that I and my colleagues have developed that explains changes in thinking during this age range and also explains changes in motivation and self-control, which, as you all know, has something to do with risky decision-making. And then based on the theory, we've designed programs to help adolescents, and that's the last part of the talk. We will be presenting evidence about the nature of those programs, how they actually affect the adolescent brain, and therefore human behavior. So those are the three parts. So I think it's important to think about some of the statistics involving adolescent risky decision making. And I could go on and on. I had a presentation where I just had slide after slide after depressing slide that had, you know, car accidents and alcohol and every kind of bad thing. But this is just some of the stand-ins for a much larger list of tragedies. So there's a lot of preventable human suffering and death that occurs as a result of poor decision-making or poor choices during this period. There's people embarking on the rest of their life. They're at the threshold of life in adolescence. They're going into the work world or into college. They're maybe going to start a family of their own and so on. This is the threshold, the launching pad, if you will, for their life. The economic cost is huge. The U.S. Department of Transportation estimates that the cost of crashes involving the drivers in this age range is $40.8 billion. Now, you could quibble about, you know, is it really only $20 billion? But that's a lot of money. And it's a leading cause of death, vehicle accidents in this age range. And some of it's due to inexperience, being inexperienced driving, but a lot of it's due to poor choices, speeding, reckless driving, driving under the influence, and so on. And another estimate, for example, said that we would have a benefit to our U.S. economy of $100 trillion. This is covered in the book, in the introduction. If our educational achievement were to match levels of the highest performing countries, if we had the same achievement as Finland and Canada, then this would add an approximate $100 trillion to our economy at a time when that kind of boost would be terrific. And of course, these young people are the future.
Educational achievement of whom?
Of Finland and Canada. So if you look at the international, like the PISA and the TIMSS and those
of
kinds of.
Everybody.
Exactly. So Finland and Canada do better than we do in these international tests, in these math and science areas. If we could be as good as Finland, Hungary does amazingly well. I mean, these are not enormously rich countries. You could say, well, Canada, okay. But, you know, we can do at least as well as Canada, I think, you know? So this is the kinds of issues that are at stake. We're talking about educational issues. We're talking about life trajectory, the using of the human mind to essentially adapt in the classroom, to adapt outside of the classroom. So the importance of the adolescent brain, because that's the instrument that's used to make these decisions. That's the instrument that's used to learn in the classroom. That's the human brain. How do you survive and thrive in a world full of temptations, in a world full of unhealthy possible risk-taking, and in a knowledge-based economy, an increasingly knowledge-based economy. So people have argued for many years that the level of the individual, and also with respect to evolution, it's that ability to adapt, to use our minds to overcome, that's really the secret to success. So that's why we want each individual young person to have that opportunity, to the ability to learn, to facilitate their learning, to facilitate their reasoning, and to facilitate their decision making, both in the classroom and in the real world. So what would be the benefits of this from a more, you know, specific perspective? Well, cognitive enrichment, or the ability to develop your mind to think about reasoning and decision making, these higher order cognitions, higher order thinking, allows you to do all kinds of things. So for example, in 2009, I wrote a review of the literature on what's called numeracy. Numeracy is just the ability to understand and use numbers. And that's actually related to your health outcomes and your medical decision making. So you actually manage your medication better if you're more numerate. And you can think about diabetes and all the things, or think about dose, giving medicine to your child by body weight, having to divide numbers. That sort of thing, it turns out, is there are millions of Americans who cannot do that. They're not able, even though they've graduated high school, they're not able to do fractions, for example. Fractions turn out to be particularly difficult. So if you think about probability and risk, so we tell a patient, if you don't manage your diabetes, this is the probability you're going to have amputation or blindness, et cetera. If you drive drunk, this is the probability that this bad thing will, and they don't know what probability is. They don't understand ratios, right? They don't know whether 0.01 is bigger or smaller than 0.001. For real. I mean, there are real standardized tests where that, and it turns out that that's related to health and medical decision making, your ability to do that. So you can see how the ability to use your mind, if you're an informed consumer, you're an informed patient, you can affect your own fate. There's things like emotion regulation. We were talking earlier, before everyone arrived, about the marshmallow study. This is the study where the child is put in the room and they can have one marshmallow, or if they wait, they get two marshmallows. So they have to resist. They're looking at the marshmallow. This is a metaphor for life. And in fact, right, that task, the ability to wait in that task, predicts 20 years later whether you're going to do well, right? Whether you're going to do well economically and educationally. The ability to delay gratification for greater rewards, like education and so on, that ability turns out to be very, very important. How did the little kids who succeeded in waiting, how did they succeed? It turns out that they distract themselves. They engage in cognitive strategies. They don't just white knuckle it and resist. I just don't think of marshmallow. They do all kinds of mental gymnastics to distract themselves from the temptation. And that's how they succeed. And that is what's correlated with later success. So we can develop the power of the human mind. We can develop the ability to regulate our emotions and engage with the world. And then the CBT there is cognitive behavioral therapy. Cognitive behavioral therapy is one of the most effective kinds of therapies available. And what is it about? It doesn't say, here's an emotional intervention for an emotional problem. It says, if we can change the way people think, we can change whether they can cope with the world. And in fact, the evidence shows that that's effective. So that's the sort of analogy that I'm getting at. In fact, I'm actually collaborating with a woman who's at Weill Medical School with paranoid delusional adolescents, people who are prodromal. In other words, they're about to manifest into a more serious illness, but they have very, very serious problems already. And she delivered a curriculum based on this fuzzy trace theory that I'm going to talk about that's basically about how do you change the way people process the information that's coming into them. And in fact, she got amazing results with this patient population by changing the nature of the thinking, and I'm going to go into detail about what the nature of that thinking is. She was actually able to reduce the delusions that patients had. So the ability to cope by using your mind is an extremely adaptive thing to do. And also staving off age-related cognitive declines. One of the most important things you can do to prevent Alzheimer's is to be educated, because you have a cognitive reserve. So all of these things are connected from the beginning trajectory of life all the way to the end of life. You're drawing on that fund that you built up, this bank account you started as an adolescent, of being educated, of having a life trajectory that's successful. And we're actually studying mild cognitive impairment and Alzheimer's too in our spare time. But we actually are using a lot of the same concepts. So this is a picture of the book, The Adolescent Brain, which again, feel free to take a copy of. And this just gives you a little bit more information and as a gateway to all kinds of resources. I am the Extension Leader for Human Development, so we've gathered together a number of resources of speakers who've come in and spoken on a range of topics of relevance to young people and so on. So that's the book. So what's different about this book? How is this book? It's different than other books perhaps about the adolescent mind and so on. Well, the first thing is it's the first book on higher cognition in the adolescent brain, taking advantage of all this recent neuroscience evidence about the brain and connecting it to this notion of higher cognition, thinking, reasoning, problem solving, decision making. Believe it or not, there's not been a book about that before this one. And a lot of the neuroscience evidence is very, very recent, so that makes sense. We also have researchers as authors, which I'm very, very proud of. So the people who contributed to this book were people who are actively doing research, which means that the material in the book is evidence-based. We also, of course, insisted on a high standard of evidence, on rigorous evidence. And again, as I mentioned before, this is particularly important in the area of adolescence, which is a kind of exciting area, and people have a lot of very strong beliefs. So for example, one of the beliefs is that adolescents take risks because they believe they're invulnerable. Turns out that's not true. It's something that we've repeated and many experts still say, but the evidence shows when you actually do research on that, they are aware that they're more vulnerable than adults are. And they, in fact, do not think they're invulnerable. If anything, they think they're going to die at a much higher probability than they are. So why not take risks? Because if you're going to die anyway, life is short, you might as well go for it. And not most of them don't believe that, but a sizable number do. Most of them do realize that because of the behaviors they're engaging in, they are in fact at higher risk than adults, than comparable adults. And then there's multiple disciplines represented between the covers of this book. We have neuroscientists. We have people who are very, very well-known in the area of education. We have a number of people contributing to this book who are experts in mathematics, for example, and how to teach mathematics. And so they're in this book as well as psychologists and so on. So one of the things we really wanted to do is bring people together across these divides of disciplines so that we could work on behalf of the adolescent and helping them be successful. We want educators to talk to psychologists and psychologists to talk to educators and neuroscientists so we can pool all this information and accelerate the translation process from the laboratory to real life. So at least that's the goal.
What's the target audience for the book?
Well, the target audience is professionals of all kinds, people ranging social workers, clinical psychologists, research folks. We really had a wide swath. As the editor, I insisted on people defining terms. Mm-hmm. And as I say in the introduction, there's also, I highly recommend the APA Dictionary for Psychology as well, which you actually can use online. This is going to have an electronic version, so you can just click on the words. Mm-hmm. So we really did try, because we had multiple disciplines represented, to make the terms, you know, more explicit than they would normally be. So it's a very difficult challenge, and you can tell me when you read the book if we managed to get there, to really make it cutting-edge research, the kind of book that would really advance the ball, not just be old things from many years ago, really on the cutting edge, but also things that people from different areas could read. That was the goal. Yeah. All right. So, as I said, the book reviews recent neuroscience discoveries about how the brain develops, their implications, and particularly the implications for how we teach young people and how we prepare them to make healthy life choices. And I should say there's several chapters in the book that talks about training and the effects of training, just like the kind of training that I'm going to talk about today that really goes in there and tries to make a difference in young people's lives. So there are ways to actually increase your fluid intelligence, it appears. So we think of intelligence as a fixed quantity. You know, you have a certain amount of IQ points at birth. It's the way many people think of it. Binet did not think of it that way, by the way. He thought of it as something malleable. But so there are ways, if you really understand the nature of the brain, that you can facilitate the development of intelligence. And there's articles about that in the book, for example. So let's get to some data, right? Massive changes in the adolescent brain. Up until recently, we did not realize how much the brain changed during adolescence. So this is an illustration of, from 5 years of age, anatomical scans of the brain, many, like 2,000 scans were summarized here, of the same kids over time, many of the same kids at multiple time points. So this is from 5 years of age all the way to 20 years of age. And over here on the right, you can see that this is thickness of gray matter, cortical thickness. So this is, you know, so as you can see, as you get into the more purplish, rather, as you get into the more, on the left here, the yellow and so on, that's thinner. And as you go from left to right, you actually see a thinning of gray matter over time. So this sort of yellowish, reddish disappears and is replaced by the blue. So you go from the top of this to the bottom of this in terms of cortical thickness, and I'll go into more detail on it. But this was an astounding finding when it first appeared. First of all, the idea that there was significant changes in the brain's, you know, morphology during adolescence was shocking, because most people thought by the time you get to be adolescence, your brain is pretty much formed. You know, the action was really here in early childhood. Au contraire, right? There's significant brain development that occurs after that, and in particular during adolescence. And the nature of the change was shocking. It was loss of gray matter. You get pruning of the brain. Your brain goes away, a lot of it goes away during this period. So that shocked a lot of people. Most of the theories of information processing and brain development would have said most of the development stops before this age. And if anything, you're adding connections, you're adding brain, right? Because you're enriching the brain. So why is the brain going down in gray matter volume? Which is kind of, you know, again.
What goes up?
Ah. I'm so glad you asked that question. Yeah, because I have a slide on that. So as you can see here, the dark lines on the top are males, and the lighter lines on the bottom are females. Males have larger brains, but that doesn't make them smarter. So as you can see, this is total brain volume over age, from 7 years of age to 19. And the gray matter over here on the right, this essentially shows what you saw in the picture, that gray matter kind of goes up a little bit and then it comes down, and it does that a little bit more sharply in the females. But in both cases, that you see that pruning or reduction in gray matter volume over time. Now white matter, and white matter has to do with the efficient connection of regions in the brain to one another. Now that goes up during that same period. So it's as though, as you can see here, there's an increase in white matter here. And there's various other things in the other part of the brain, like the connections between the hemispheres, that also increases. So the overall picture here, and this is like each one of the scans, the trajectories all mapped on top of one another. The dark ones, again, are the males on the top, and the light gray ones are the females on the bottom. So this shows you every data point that went into all of these averages. As you can see, there's a huge amount of variability. That's mainly the message of the thing on the left. But as you can see also, as they go up, you get that increase and then the downward turn. But this is the averages right here on the right for that. So what is the denouement of all of that? Well, there are, in terms of broadly consistent explanations, like why would the connections go up and the gray matter go down? If you think about that in broad terms, this is consistent with the behavioral evidence that we've gathered on fuzzy trace theory. Now, what is a fuzzy trace? A fuzzy trace is your encoding of experience based on the gist. It's the bottom line, vague, qualitative essence of information or experience. So if you go away from this discussion, and a week from now someone says, what did Valerie Reina talk about, you know, when you went to that talk she gave? You would probably not remember exact words. But hopefully I would have communicated some essential bottom line pieces of information, and that's what you would take away and remember and use in the future. So people encode what's called a gist representation. It means just what you think it means. This is the everyday use of the term. And they also, at the same time, encode what's called a verbatim representation, which is the exact wording. The verbatim representation fades very rapidly, so you can't exactly remember exact wording, but you hold on to the gist over a longer period of time. And what this theory says is that, and it's based on a lot of evidence, and I won't torture you with all of that, but there's mathematical models and experiments where we test hypotheses, we make predictions, and then we test them and that sort of thing. But what the data have shown is that there's greater reliance on gist in adulthood. So as you move from childhood to adulthood, you become more bottom line oriented, more thinking about just the basic, essential, bottom line of information and less caught up in the details. It's as though you see the forest as opposed to each individual tree and getting wrapped up in the individual superficial details. So that's across many, many different tasks. So the essential bottom line of information is the concept of less is more. So that's broadly consistent with this notion that based on experience, parts of the brain that aren't really needed go away, and we create this superhighway, this expressway of connections that's integrated and more connected. Simpler, less cut to the chase kind of information processing. And that's why, of course, you get greater connectivity. So there's this notion of gist-based intuition that you use to process information. We have a very specific definition of intuition, and verbatim-based analysis. And there's two ways, really, you can approach many, many different problem-solving tasks, many, many different decisions in life. You can focus on the exact details. What's the probability that I'm going to get in a car accident if I drive drunk? Okay, on the highway. It's only 2 miles. It's only 4 miles. What's the probability? Low, probably. All right? If you do it a lot, the cumulative probability is high, right? But the individual instance is low. So if you think about all that superficial detail, you miss the big point, which is, are you kidding? Don't do that. That's really dumb, right? So that's what we're talking about. So a lot of people talk about risky decision making in terms of sensation seeking and self-control. And when I talked before about the Walter Mischel, you know, resisting the marshmallow, I was talking about self-control. How do you control yourself and the strategies for doing that? So what we try to do in fuzzy trace theory is we try to bring all these things together. How young people think, how adults think, how that changes with age, and then how do the emotions and motivations mix in there with your thinking? And if you think back to the example about cognitive behavioral therapy, if you think about things differently, if you frame them differently, you have different emotions. You have different motivations. If you see the world in a different way, if you parse it differently, that changes what's tempting anymore. I just don't think of a donut the same way since I read our curriculum. You know, we have this obesity prevention curriculum, and I like donuts. I thought donuts were sort of harmless. Oh, my goodness. And my apologies to the donut industry. I still eat your donuts. But, you know a lot more about donuts, shall we say, now than I used to know. And I just look at them differently than I did before. They have a different image to me at a very basic level. And what the data have shown is that it's the basic valence of that image, not the details, you know, that move us and motivate us. So if you think about smoking in movies, right, that's an image. Unfortunately, it's a cool image, right? It still is today, and it's still used to immediately communicate that in movies, right? And it's not the details. It's just, you know, that kind of general valence. So what so we think sensation seeking just means wanting that excitement, wanting that reward, wanting that sizzle in life, like young people do, right? And that's true. They do want that. And then self-control. But also much adolescent risk-taking, and this is a very radical notion, but it is based on data, and I'm going to show you some of the data. What we have shown, and I've reviewed the literature too, looking at other people's data, and what that's shown is that a lot of this risk-taking is not impulsive. Some of it is. Some of it is acting without thinking. A lot of it is calculated and considered. Weighing a cost-benefit kind of analysis, thinking about it very logically, and then deciding to take a risk because it's, quote, worth it for the benefits. So that's a very different kind of thinking than many adults have who are getting along in the world.
Mm-hmm. You're describing the stock market.
Yes, exactly.
It's a perfect analogy.
Thank you.
Man.
Yes, and who's drawn to playing gambles? Not the average person, because most people, and this has been shown for centuries in risk-taking research, the average adult is risk-averse for gains, meaning they prefer a smaller, sure thing to the upside potential of being, you know, really rich. But there's a small group of people, and these are the sensation seekers who want that thrill, who want that reward, who want more. Does anyone remember that movie with Edgar G. Robinson where he says, "What do you want, Rocco?" What do you want, Rocco? More. I want more. There's people like that. They want more. So, you know, they don't want to be safe. They want more. So that's a so there's that small group of people, and those are the people I would think would be attracted to gambling of all forms.
Those are the ones who did with pyramid schemes.
Yeah.
Would their brains look like adolescent brains?
Well, that's a really interesting question. We must do that study. There's the neuroscience technology, the magnetic resonance imaging and functional magnet is very new. And I would have to look up and see if people have done pathological gambling and whether they've actually looked at their brain and whether they've compared it to adolescents. There's not a lot of, I mean, there's a little bit of work on adolescence in the brain. There's some, and we summarize it in this book. But there's been a lot of work that hasn't been done. We're actually starting to do some of that work ourselves, yeah.
You know, for me, I think about the way that companies, say, like auto makers, decide whether mm-hmm. they're going to recall a car or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they weigh out the cost and the benefits.
Exactly.
And it's not as simple as, oh, my God, people are being killed because there's a dangerous or defective part. It's like, well, let's think about this for a second.
Mm-hmm.
What's the, you know, how many people are being killed? How much is it going to cost, you know, for mm-hmm. the payout of the price of a lawsuit? And is it going to cost more money for the lawsuit, or is it going to cost more money? You know, so there's that.
Yeah.
There's
that's
that,
weighing, that, trading
weighing,
off
exactly.
the probability and the magnitude of the loss. Mm-hmm. And they do engage in verbatim-based analysis.
Right.
And in fact, sometimes that is a good idea. Sometimes, especially, I think, in situations where, you know, long-term payouts from retirement, you really want to calculate it out often. And that's because there are other humans in the marketplace who are trying to sell you something.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not really, you know, although people tell me who are in investment, no, they use just two. Accountants tell me we use just all the time. Accounting is about judgment and inference. It's not about a bunch of rules that you follow like a cookbook. It's really about understanding. So in that case, it would be not just about the superficial details of is it 9.2 million or 9.1 million. You know, so the question is when in medical decisions and health decisions can an insight that cuts through the details really be the right thing? And often we're saying that is true in adolescence in these public health domains. So think about, for example, HIV risk. If you were to calculate your probability of getting HIV, it would be low in almost every population, even in fairly high-risk populations. The AIDS, you know, the HIV virus is not transmitted very easily compared to like the cold virus and other things. So if you just thought about the facts, you might be tempted. And in fact, young people are tempted. The benefits of sex and the risk, and they weigh them, and you know, they're willing to take risks that we would think are appalling. And if you just think of it as a calculation, they're right. But if you think of it as a categorical possibility of disaster, that would be just the categorical possibility of a really bad thing, right? Then you'd think about it in a different way. And that's what we're trying to inculcate in our curriculum, as a matter of fact. So, sensation seeking and self-control. Let me show you a little bit about the motivational things first, too. Now, a lot of the brain theories, and Adriana Galvan has a wonderful chapter in the book that summarizes the latest research on that, and this is just another summary article that's recent. This is a theoretical graph, and it shows age increasing from left to right here on the x-axis and development of the brain on the y-axis. And so the theory goes, and there's evidence for it, these subcortical regions of the brain, like the limbic areas, the amygdala, the parts of the brain that respond to reward, you know, they get all excited about all of these wonderful fun things one might do, that those develop earlier than the parts of the brain that have to do with self-control, the prefrontal cortex and lateral prefrontal cortex and so on. These cortical areas come online later than the emotion and reward areas of the brain, and therefore there's this gap in adolescence between the amount of reward you're experiencing, you know, so your brain gets all excited about, ooh, boy, fun thing that we're going to do, but your ability to control has not come online yet. Now, this is a theoretical curve. There's evidence for this in terms of activation of what's called the nucleus accumbens in the brain, which is a reward center in the brain, being more active in adolescence. There's a lot of variability, and there's only a few studies, but there is evidence for this. And the prefrontal cortex coming online and being less able to control emotional responses during this age period. So there's evidence for this. And in fact, some students and I did a study, and this is actual data as opposed to a theoretical curve, that's sort of broadly consistent with this notion. And these are all, by the way, Cornell students. This is a grad student from Cornell, an undergraduate from Cornell, an undergraduate from Cornell, undergraduate from Cornell, and a graduate student. And some of them are in law school, and some of them are in medical school now, and this article just came out. But if you look, for example, at this curve, this is real means, and this is age across the bottom again, from 14 to 21, and then mean rating on two kinds of rating scales. On the one hand, we have this curvilinear pattern that goes up significantly and then comes down. I don't know if you can see it. Let me try this. Yeah, there we go. It goes up and then comes down. This is sensation seeking. This is a questionnaire that's very reliable that we give to young people. And, you know, I like to go to wild parties. Yeah, I agree with that. You know, I want to go bungee jumping. Remember bungee jumping? Anyway.
I never wanted to do that.
Me either. I don't understand it. I just want to go on the little merry-go-round that goes around in a circle. You know, I'm not, you know, it's score low on this. But anyway, so there is this, and this has been shown, you know, over the years, that there's a peak in sensation seeking around adolescence. So that's consistent with this brain idea. That those areas are becoming more sensitized to reward during this period. And then they come down, right, with age. And then you see this sort of linear pattern in what's called the behavioral inhibition scale. This is the responsiveness to fear, to punishment, to consequences, right? So this, in that questionnaire, this went steadily up with age. This is actually significantly different than this. So it goes up. And as you can see, the gap between the ability to control your behavior through fear and consequences versus to be excited by rewards, this gap gets bigger. And therefore, your ability to control yourself actually increases.
Are you male or female?
These are both, male and female.
Say the top.
So this is behavioral inhibition, to control your impulses here. And to respond to, I might get punished, I might get in trouble, that kind of thing. So this goes up steadily with age, your ability to inhibit, right? And then your ability to get excited, that goes up, but then it falls. So here you're less tempted and better able to control yourself. This gap is helps you resist risk-taking over here on the right. Over here, they're battling it out for who's in control. The reward center says, reward me, you know? And the inhibition center says, okay. Right? So that's the disparity that the theoretical curve was talking about. So these behavioral data are consistent with the brain data. Okay? So there are motivational differences. They're being tempted more than we are, and they're less able to inhibit. All right? So if you put that together, you get greater reward sensitivity and inhibition in adolescence and this asymmetry in brain development. But also, adolescents who take unhealthy risks also reason differently. They think differently. They're like from another planet in some ways, right? So they're not just younger versions of us, adolescents. They really have a different way of thinking. And that different way of thinking we're talking about is verbatim-based analysis, cost-benefit kind of thing like you were talking about. So they think about risks as about playing the odds, calculating, play the odds. The odds are with you. You know when young people say, it isn't going to happen to me, and we say, boy, are they crazy to say that? They're actually technically correct. The base rate guess is that whatever that bad thing, it's not majority. It's not 90% of people are going to fall over dead because they had a cheeseburger right then and there, right? Or most people don't necessarily die of lung cancer from smoking. Even if they smoke, they die of a whole range of things. If you added them up, they'd be massive. Yeah, but that one thing isn't going to necessarily get them. So technically, they're right about the details, but obviously they're missing the point, and we would say they're missing the gist, right? So the kind of thinking that would be exemplified in gist-based intuition would be, it just takes once. It just takes once to get pregnant. It just takes once to get HIV. It just takes once to die in a way that could have been prevented. You know, you don't have the rest of your life, or to have some awful injury, right? So if you think about that, that makes such sense to us, I think, right? But it's actually technically wrong, right? We're not the logical ones, they are. Because it just takes once. It's not a numerical quantitative concept of probability. In fact, there are curricula for teenagers, exactly, that say we got to train this out of them. That's a bad way to think, and we have to teach them probability theory, and they should make gradations of risk, and they should make these fine yes, this is most of the literature, really. I can show you and I have some friends who actually developed these curricula, and we get involved in these very friendly debates about, is that a good thing to teach them or not? Well, I'm going to show you some evidence that speaks directly to that point about whether it's good or bad to think it only takes once and so on. So, and then, you know, again, I think we've probably gone over this, but this is, why would it be a healthy thing to be, you know, an intuitive gist-based thinker? Because it does only take once, and these things are categorically different, and we don't want them to start. If people are weighing the odds, they're already on the wrong path. if they're thinking about, gee, how probable would it be if I got AIDS if I did this, this, and this? This is not a good sign, right? They're thinking in a way that we would probably find appalling. So global risk avoidance, or GIST-based thinking, ignores the magnitude of potential benefits and thus is protective. It says, this is so awful, or so potentially, you know, going to destroy my life, that I'm not going to weigh the odds. I'm just going to not do this. All right? I'm going to have a policy, like adults think. Right?
Wait, go back.
Okay.
One.
Sure.
The magnitude of
potential benefits. So, unfortunately, there are benefits to some of these things. They are rewarding. You know, having sex has its rewards. Oh, now they have me on tape. Oh well, I guess I can't deny that, can I? Anyway, so but it has risks. So the idea is that there are benefits, and if you have ratings from adolescents, if you ask them, okay, rate on a 1 to 7 scale, how beneficial is this activity of a whole variety of types? If you look through the literature, and I've reviewed the literature, whether it's alcohol, sex, all of these different kinds of risk-taking, they rate the benefits as very high, and they rate the risks as high. In fact, they overestimate risks. But the benefits are so high, they outweigh the risks. So again, if you're just calculating, clearly the message is do it, right? If you're being a rational, you know, economist-like thinker, weighing the costs and benefits, you would take the risk because it would be, quote, worth it because of the benefits. They would offset that trade-off kind of thinking, right? So here's a scale that we developed ourselves based on this theory. It says, well, if this is true, then we ought to be able to measure this kind of thinking scientifically, this categorical thinking about risk. And it has items like this. If you keep having unprotected sex, the risks will add up and you're going to get pregnant. Eventually, it's going to be 1.0, right? We don't say exactly when or how much. It just says, look, the point is it's going to add up. It's going to be 1.0. It's going to happen eventually, right? And they add up faster than you think, right? Even low risks add up to 100% if you keep doing it. It only takes once to get pregnant or to get an STD. Once you have AIDS, there's no second chance, et cetera. These are all categorical. They're not quantitative nuances, they're qualitative categorical. You know, this is bad. This is an all or none type way of thinking. So, and then they have a 5-point scale, strongly disagree to strongly agree on this kind of scale, and it has good reliability. So that's a kind of GIST thinking. Here's another scale that we use to measure this kind of thinking. It's called the GIST principle scale. And by principles, we mean like values, all right? So what matters to you? We do not impose our values on young people in these curriculum. We ask them, what do you value? They say, well, I actually care about my parents. Many young people really care about their parents, and they don't want to disappoint their parents. And they look up to their parents. So that's actually a motivator. So we say, if any of these are things that you believe in that motivate you, you just check them off. The more of these basic bottom line sort of policies and values you check off, the less likely you are to have unprotected sex and all of these other things, right? So it's very simple. These are not detailed, you know, kinds of things. Well, only on Tuesdays between 2 and 4, you know. This is very bottom line kind of values and principles. So and that's part of our curriculum as well. So that's one of the things we measure. So based on this theory, we've developed programs. With the help of my colleagues who are here, we're implementing these all over the place. And the main things that are different, that's different about our approach, is rather than have kids memorize a whole long list of health facts, you know, the HPV, human papilloma virus base rate is 24.5%, you know, in college age students, that sort of thing. We say, human papilloma, that's the stuff that causes warts, it's really higher than you think. A lot of people have that, and you know, and it's a virus. And a virus means you can't take a pill for it, right? That would be the other thing, right? You can't. This is stuff you can't necessarily cure. So we talk about how to think differently in this GIST bottom line kind of way, how to retrieve your values in context rapidly and automatically, and then how to apply the values to your mental representation to output the decision. So that's mainly the three things that are different about our approach. So in this New York sample that I'm talking about, there are 189 students enrolled so far, altogether counting all sites. About 55% are female. As you can see, this is a diverse population, 29% African American. And a lot of the folks who are other are mixed, various ethnicities. And about 17% are Hispanic. And we have two arms to this curriculum. One of them is this pregnancy prevention curriculum that I mostly talked about, pregnancy and STD prevention. But also there's another arm of it that's the beginnings of an obesity prevention curriculum. We scoured the literature, and we're looking for a curriculum that had been tested using randomized control trials, you know, with real experiments and a control group and that sort of stuff on obesity prevention in this age group, and there weren't any. Yeah. Do you have a question? No. You just say, okay. I'm used to my students, you know, I'm trained to respond immediately when I see a hand. I'm salivating, too. So the obesity prevention curriculum, as you know, obesity is an incredible public health threat. And it turns out there was a study, a paper presented at the American Heart Association in November of this, just this past year, saying that based on a representative sample of adolescents in this country, that this is the most unhealthy generation in history since they've been measuring. Right now, we have adolescents who are the most unhealthy. There was nobody, none of the people in the sample, there's like over 5,000 kids in the study, who actually scored well on the health indices, exercise, diet, so on. Nobody did well. This is sort of appalling. And again, these kinds of lifestyle decisions that are made in adolescence affect the rest of your life. You start building up these plaques in your arteries at that age. You build up your lifestyle habits. Those are formed at this age. Eventually, if you have a family, you transmit those to the next generation. So we thought this is an opportunity maybe to expand the kinds of things we're doing. We're just starting out, so at the moment we're taking the standard curriculum that other people have developed called Eat Fit, an award-winning extension program that's never been evaluated using a randomized control trial. We're evaluating it as step one, and then we're going to adapt it to try to get it to be as effective as possible. So young people are randomized to one of these two arms, so they either get this reducing the risk for pregnancy and STDs, or they get the obesity prevention. So each group is the control group for the other group, if you will, but they both hopefully get something of value. So that's the one way, so you can have your cake and eat it too in terms of scientific design. So here are the locations around New York. We go from Queens, Brooklyn, Harlem, Bronx, and so on. And then we have other sites in New York, Broome County, and also Central New York. So we've kind of been all, thanks to our collaborators, we've managed to kind of get all over New York and have a variety of different kinds of populations, which we're very grateful for. Now, this is a little bit of a busy slide, but I wanted to give you some flavor of what the curriculum was. What we did is we took what's called Reducing the Risk, a curriculum to reduce sexual risk-taking and pregnancy and STDs, and we justified it. So we just took an effective curriculum, one that the CDC said had evidence to support it being effective, and we said it's far from fully effective, but we want to start with a head start. And we're going to take that and we're going to get to what's the bottom line of each lesson, what's the essence, do the kids get the gist before they leave the door? Not all the details, but do they get the main point of what we're saying? And so we took that curriculum, we justified it, we had a list of values that kids could endorse and select that were their personal values that they thought were relevant, like 3 to 5 of them, a small number. And then we would reinforce those at each lesson with role-playing and a variety of kinds of pedagogical techniques to reach young people. So this was, we did evaluate this in an 807 adolescent randomized controlled trial, the original version of the curriculum. We're doing an extension of that that adds the obesity prevention and also enhances that from Arizona, Texas, and New York. And, of course, this is a collaboration between my lab in Ithaca and the Cornell Cooperative Extension. So we're also fine-tuning the curriculum and so on and rolling it out beyond just the research environment, which we think is very, very important. We want to be able to have this be the kind of curriculum that people can implement all over the place. So it consists of 14 one-hour lessons. That's all, 14 hours in a very, you know, busy life of young people where there's many, many influences. So you think, 14 hours, how could possibly affect anything? I'm going to let the cat out of the bag. It does, or I wouldn't be talking about it, right? There's instructions in small groups and school settings and youth programs, role-playing. And we also encourage communication with parents. As part of the curriculum, we think parents are very important, and we encourage and give kids tips on how to approach their parents about these delicate issues and so on, so that the parents' values are instilled in the children. And you'd be amazed at what people don't talk about, right? I know the people working with me wouldn't be amazed, but anyway. So we also do surveys because it's very, very important to have research evidence. So many programs are delivered to young people, and people say, well, we don't have time to evaluate them properly. But that's a tragedy. You know, we might have all kinds of effective things out there, but we really don't know what we have, because we don't really assess. So we assess. We have the original questionnaire had 314 items on it, these poor young people. But we begged and we pleaded and we follow up. So thanks to, again, everyone's help. So again, this curriculum emphasizes understanding the gist of knowledge to avoid or reduce behavior, engaging in gist-based thinking rather than detailed analysis of the pros and cons, quickly and automatically recognizing signs and signals in a bottom-line intuitive way. This is this is going to be a forced sex situation. So for example, you're going to love this. When you tell young people something like the following, it's prom night. You all have rented a hotel room. There's alcohol. Okay, does anyone know the end of the story? Would anybody be surprised by the end of the story? But Mom, I'm so responsible. I've never done anything bad. I can go to the hotel room. It's okay, right? I'm not going to do anything wrong. I've thought about this logically, right? Does this sound familiar? Anyone? Right? So we immediately connect the dots. That's what gist is. We use our experience in life to go, uh-oh. Right? So that uh-oh response, that's what we're trying to get them to have insight to. The immediate uh-oh. You don't have to say, okay, who's the boy, and is he responsible? We don't need to know who the boy is. We don't need to know who the girl is, right? We already know, trouble, trouble, right? So that's what we're talking about here, getting that intuitive, immediate sense that something might happen. It's not unpredictable. It's highly predictable. Right? And that's the gist. We can't really explain why we think that. And if we got into a sort of logic match, they'd win because they have logic on their side. Then nobody's done anything wrong, da-da-da-da. But we know. Trouble, right? So that's what we try to get, that kind of intuition. So quickly and automatically retrieving their core values and principles that are relevant and applying them. And again, it may seem obvious that if you have strongly held values, right, like this would disappoint my parents, or I care about my partner and I don't want to hurt my partner, and maybe my partner doesn't want to get pregnant and so on and has a future and all that, you'd think that those strongly held values would be retrieved. But one of the things we know from research is even if you know something really well and you really believe it, you don't necessarily retrieve it in context when you need it. You retrieve it later, and that's called regret, right? But this is true across a gamut of things, right? We don't retrieve what we strongly believe necessarily. You have to become automatized to do that. So very different approach than other curricula. Other curricula want a reflective teenager. And we say, if you're reflecting, it's too late, right? We want you to respond the way troops in battle respond to gunfire. If the troops really thought about it, they'd be running the other way, maybe, okay? But you have to be trained. You have to be overtrained and overlearn. What do you do when bullets start flying and you're scared and you're in harm's way? What should you do when you're under emotional duress? That's the sort of thing. We want this so overlearned and automatic that they immediately think about it, they don't reflect, they don't calculate, and they know what to do, and they can apply those values. So a very, very fundamentally different kind of approach in our theory than in other theories. Okay. So, you know, these are examples of gist. Viruses like herpes are not curable. You have them and give them to others for the rest of your life. Again, if you don't have background knowledge about medicine, you don't know that. That's news to a lot of kids. Germs are germs, right? Reducing the risk of STDs, other than not having sex, the second best thing is to use condoms. And then, of course, our categorical thinking and cumulative risk gists. Of course, we directly teach those. Here's examples, of course, again, of the principles. Never have sex because of pressure. It's always a bad idea if you're being pressured and that's the reason you're doing it. When in doubt, delay or avoid. Saying no today does not mean saying no forever. You know, and again, these are so simple, right? These are not elaborate manifestos. They're bottom line, we hope, wisdom that gets across to young people what we maybe learned the hard way, right? We don't want them to have to learn the hard way. All right, so what about data? Now, I've got beta values here, but don't worry, I'll explain what they mean. And this is predicting, if you look at sexual intentions, so these are self-reported intentions to have sex of young people. And you look, what predicts sexual intentions? Well, it turns out that sensation-seeking, that desire for rewards, that does predict whether you have high sexual intentions. Indeed, that's significantly. This is how much weight there is to this X in terms of predicting this Y. So how much does sensation seeking has an effect on whether you have high sexual intentions? You're one of these people that's you're reward driven, you're more likely to have sex as a teenager. What about those GIST principles? Well, indeed, that reduces your risk. There's a negative coefficient here. That means the more you agree with these bottom line principles that I showed you a list of, the lower your sexual intentions, significantly lower. All right, so these little asterisks over here mean significant. Your knowledge of the facts, that's actually positively correlated with sexual intentions. Why? Because you're probably looking up birth control and finding out about a lot of things that if you don't have that as a relevant behavior, you're not terribly interested in. So that's interesting. So you know all the knowledge about what's effective contraception and all these other things because you're more likely to be engaging in the behavior and have higher intention. And gender. If you're male and you're a teenager, you heard it here first, you have more intentions to have sex. I know this is not news, but but at least we found the obvious. So that, as you can see, there's motivational components here, and there's how you think. All of this is determining whether people have intentions to have sex. And this is with our sample of 189. This is our at the pretest, when they come in, what predicts their current sexual intentions and their current sexual behavior at the outset. So this is the New York sample and the New York data. If you look at sexual behavior, and we presented this in terms of, for the tape, a linear regression, but we really did a logistic regression, which is the proper analysis. But this puts this all on the same footing as the other. And this is just whether you initiate sex. And if you so did you initiate sex yet at 15 and a half on average? Remember, it was about 15.7 years on average for the sample. Have you started having sex or not? And what predicts that? Well, what predicts that is, again, how sensation-seeking you are, how reward-driven you are, how tempted you are. But also, it reduces the probability of you, that you've initiated sex if you adhere to these basic bottom-line GIST principles. Now, these other factors are not significant, probably because this is a dichotomous variable of yes, no, right? But as you can see, the reward and the way you think both predict whether you've initiated sex. And then finally, the number of sexual partners you've had. So as we know, if you increase your number of sexual partners, you increase the probability you're going to get sexually transmitted infections and all kinds of things. And probably, you know, we're talking again about 15 and a half year olds on average here. So once again, here now sensation seeking does not significantly predict the number of partners, but the GIST principle still remains a significant predictor of the number of partners. The more you adhere to those basic principles, the fewer number of sexual partners you will have. So that predicts that. And that's, in fact, the only significant predictor in this analysis of number of sexual partners. And we have a lot of other data, but I wanted to show you the New York data in particular. And then finally, do we know whether this curriculum is effective? This is, of course, you know, the big question. Can we inculcate this kind of thinking in people? Now, with this 189, we don't have enough subjects yet to really do a fair test of the curriculum of obesity. Pretty soon, we're hoping to enroll enough. But we did do this kind of analysis with the three groups that I talked to you before about in Texas and New York and Arizona. And we had a reducing the risk arm, which is just the standard curriculum, no GIST enhancement. Then we had what we call RTR plus, which is applying fuzzy trace theory, this GIST-based intuition kind of thinking. And then we had a control group, which actually had a friendship intervention about relationships with other people and friendship that wasn't about sex or sexual transmitted disease and other kinds of things. And the question is, was the enhanced curriculum any better than the curriculum already shown to be effective? Does this theory have any, you know, actual worth in terms of helping young people, in terms of the outcome? Well, no more numbers, but I'll give you sort of the, I hope, bottom line. This is an analysis comparing the standard curriculum, the GIST enhanced curriculum, how things changed over time, because we followed them up over time, and then how those changes interacted. I wouldn't worry about the time so much, just worry about the curriculum here for now. A negative coefficient means that there is, in terms of predicting number of sexual partners, the RTR plus, the GIST enhanced curriculum, had significantly lowered the number of sexual partners. If you were in that group as opposed to the control group, you had a lower number of sexual partners. So that's a negative coefficient. That means decrease. The numbers went down. If your intentions to have sex were significantly lower in the GIST enhanced curriculum, there weren't significant differences in the RTR for these particular outcome measures. Now, most of the curricula, people have done these wonderful reviews of the literature of these curricula. Most curricula, the effective ones, have an effect on two or three outcome variables. They don't have an effect on 12 or 14. They have an effect on two or three, which is considered good. That's like top curricula have an effect on two or three. So this is some of the ones that we have an effect of. Your intentions to use birth control go up significantly in the GIST enhanced curriculum, and they also go up in the regular curriculum as well, because remember that is in fact an effective curriculum. So these are behavioral outcomes that were shown in a randomized clinical trial with 807 young people, adolescents, to be significantly more effective when you added these concepts about GIST. Okay. What about attitudes and norms? How did the curricula affect sexual attitudes? How permissive you felt about sex? It's okay to do it, you know? Everybody's doing it, it's okay to do it. That's these kinds of things. So sexual norms would be everybody's doing it. You know, my friends are all having sex, and I'm going to, again, and that tends to have a positive, as you can imagine, it's been shown that the more you believe that, the more likely you are to have sex. So again, the RTR plus GIST enhanced lowered these permissive attitudes. You had a less permissive attitude. You said, no, it's not a good idea necessarily to have sex. So that had a greater effect than the standard curriculum. Your attitudes towards birth control were enhanced in both of these groups. Your sexual norms went down, meaning you thought fewer of your friends were having sex. That's actually more accurate, right? So you don't believe everybody's doing it if you're in the RTR plus group. And your norms for whether people who are having sex are using birth control, you now say, yes, people have sex use birth control. That's normal, right? So that had an effect in both curricula. And these are mediators of behavior. They've been shown to be mediators of behavior. I showed you behavior first because that's really the bottom line, right? But these are the things that cause behavior, right? So again, what about self-efficacy? Your ability to say no to sex. There is a remarkable amount of not consensual sex that happens among young people, either with older people, older men, you know, with younger girls. And this ability, this self-efficacy, this belief in your ability to say no is something that can be taught and can be taught effectively. And as you can see in both curricula, in all of these things, there were effects of both curricula, significant effects vis-a-vis the control group, where you got a better ability to say no, ability to use birth control. You felt you were more able to do it. I can go to the store. I can do this. I can implement this. Behavioral control. You feel you have control over your fate as opposed to things happening to you passively. And then the reasons not to have sex. You agree with more reasons not to have sex than you did relative to the control group. And knowledge and GIST and warnings. Remember the uh-oh remark? Remember the uh-oh? Well, that goes up significantly in both intervention groups, as you can see. So there's a lot of effects on the nature of the thinking, the categorical thinking, the GIST principles, and so on. All right. And in closing, and I know you probably have questions, I just wanted to put in a plug for our new magnetic resonance imaging machine that we're going to be acquiring in Ithaca, Cornell. Weill Cornell has had these for a little while, but this is the first non-clinical magnetic resonance imaging device that's going to be available in Ithaca. And I'm the co-director of this facility, and we plan to explore some of these things, including the mechanisms behind good outcomes in young people. We're looking at adolescent risk-taking while imaging their brains during these kinds of decisions.
So that's a machine.
This is the machine. This is, okay. It's going to scan the brain. Yeah, exactly.
I asked Chrissy how big the machine was. And they just put there. So it's like an MRI machine.
It's exactly an MRI machine.
Okay. So
and we design experiments where we're able to then isolate different areas of activation in the brain based on our hypotheses. Remember we showed those developmental curves about how the brain changes and what we think the brain's doing? These kinds of devices allow you to test those hypotheses and really literally look into the mind. And we actually have preliminary data where we can see behavioral effects in the brain signals. Oh, it's cool.
But what are you going to ask? What are you going to ask them? Are they supposed to be thinking about things?
No, we devise experiments that test hypotheses. So we have ways to manipulate whether you think verbatim or you think GIST. We actually have, based on our theory, ways to induce GIST-based thinking about risk that cause you, for example, in a game frame to be risk-averse. We can experimentally induce that kind of thinking based on the underlying mechanisms. I didn't show you those data because, as you can imagine, it's fairly complex. But anyway, or we can get you to think more verbatim, more about the details and the numbers and so on, and then you're more risk-seeking in the game frame. We actually can induce that at will in people by changing the way you think and the way we present information. And we're going to study that in adolescents, who we think are more verbatim-based to begin with. So we're going to be able to ideally see certain areas of the brain light up when they make risky choices about outcomes that vary in magnitude and probability.
Based on responses to scenarios or questions that you might have while they're
in the... And those scenarios, we've already shown that those scenarios predict risk-taking in real life. That 2011 paper that we showed actually shows that there's a connection, a prediction between what people do in the laboratory and what they do in the real world in terms of risky decision making. These are robust attitudes and ways of thinking that extend and are able to predict.
We're going to be sending out to a lot of the students who have been in the program. So.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So just the final kind of summary of all this, because I know it's a little overwhelming. There is, on the one hand, a kind of thinking, this verbatim-based analysis, I'm calling it a kind of hyper-rationality that's acting, taking a risk by thinking about it, by calculating it. And a lot of adolescents engage in that. When I review the literature, their perception of the risks and benefits predicted their risk-taking. So if you took their benefits and you took their risk and you multiplied, you got the likelihood that they would engage in risk-taking. And if it's impulsive, you should not see that. You should see, oh, I regret it, I did what I don't really believe. But what the teenagers are telling us is, no, I actually did. I lost the roll of the dice. It didn't come out the way I wanted to, but I was going with the odds. So there's that hyper-rationality that promotes risk-taking in adolescents, a very different way of thinking than adults. Then there's the standard impulsivity. That also accounts for risk-taking and the notion of responding to rewards. And then there's these developmental changes in the relationship between emotion, the limbic system, and the higher cognition, the prefrontal cortex, and other higher order areas of the brain, and that relationship is changing simultaneously. And then finally, bottom line is, we think about learning, reasoning, and decision making, again, as these fixed quantities. I mean, kids just develop, the brain just matures. But the brain matures as a function of experience. And we can change the way people think. We've shown that in the randomized control trial, and we've shown it in other experiments, that we are not just, young people are not just fated to be risk takers, and we're just going to lose thousands of them. We actually can make a difference, and with each succeeding experiment, we're trying to increase or potentiate those effects in terms of health-promoting behaviors. And then, of course, I've got to thank all the wonderful people here who made it all possible, all the wonderful students. We have actual students, undergraduates and graduate students who deliver this curricula, as well as the great folks here. I'm so glad you're here. Jackie, Michelle, and Eduardo, who delivered the curriculum in New York City themselves, and they're right here.
Michelle and Eduardo.
Yes, exactly. And NIH for funding the initial randomized control trial and our current funding, which is from USDA. We have a little bit of funding to do that obesity prevention. We're kind of, you know, operating on a shoestring for this type phase of our work, but we're getting it done. And it's, you know, as we say, paso a paso, we're getting it done, you know. But anyway, thank you so much. We're a small group. Been doing neuroimaging of adult brains. And we're looking at, guess what, sensation seeking and those kinds of things and seeing. And I was just calculating before you came in, I got a little work done, and I was writing down the correlations with brain activations between sensation seeking and exactly this kind of thing we're talking about.
So once they're adults, they're pretty much incurable.
Well, there's a small group of people that remain sensation seekers, and I don't think they're incurable. I don't, again, thanks so much, Michelle. Thank you so much. You know, hugs, right? Yeah. So I don't think people are incurable. I think what you have to do is channel those impulses. So, for example, let me give you a real-life example. This is an example. He knows I use him as an example. He's an old friend. Richard Carmona. Does anybody know who Richard Carmona? Yes. Oh, very good. Jane gets the prize.
He was a chancellor, school chancellor.
Actually, Surgeon General.
Surgeon General.
Okay. I knew you knew him, though. Okay. Richard Carmona was U.S. Surgeon General. He was a friend of mine in Tucson. And he was a young man who started out in New York, as a matter of fact. He's Latino, and he got into a little trouble as an adolescent with the law. And he dropped out of high school, and he had all the risk factors, and he's clearly an example of sensation seeking. I know him. So he's a trauma surgeon SWAT team member in Tucson. So he would, you know, carry a gun, and just, he was, you know, an unusual fellow. But he started off going exactly down the wrong path, right? Exactly down the wrong path. Background not affluent at all, you know, and so on. He went to Vietnam, okay? And in those days, if you didn't have a high school diploma, you could go to the Army and so on. He became a medic, Then he became a nurse. Then he went to medical school. He became a trauma surgeon. He even got a master's in public health. And guess how I met him? We were sitting around writing a grant for a youth program in Tucson, the two of us, because we both care, because we come from those kinds of backgrounds where a lot of things happen to people that were preventable. And we were there, I think it was like Christmas Eve too, not good, but you know, it was due, you understand. I know you can relate, Jackie. Yeah. So that's how I met him. And he was clearly a risk-taking, stimulus-seeking, you know, he ran, you know, when the gunfire was going off, he thought that was exciting. The rest of us would be like, oh no. He's like, yeah, you know. He's a SWAT team, he gets out there and he goes into hostage situations, he's the doc, right? So guns are blazing, he has the bulletproof vest on, you know. Clearly, he was headed down the wrong path because of some of those individual differences. That stimulus seeking was getting him to trouble, right? But then he challenged it. What does a trauma surgeon have to do? Blood is gushing, people are screaming, half the people are drunk, yelling. He loves it, mm-hmm. right? He loves it. So he went into an environment that was able to take advantage of his sensation seeking. Mm-hmm. I would be overstimulated by that, right? He was like, I can handle it, right? Now I'm about right, right? People are yelling, that's good, you know? So that was a way to channel that kind of thing. So it wasn't a death sentence. It wasn't the end of his life. It was something he, in fact, could use as a talent.
To dovetail on that question, one of the things that kept coming to mind as I was as you were sharing your research and the findings is that we know that young people, I mean, if we think about the ecological model, mm-hmm. young people grow up in households with parents, with adults, you know, they grow up in communities, mm-hmm. they grow up in a society. Mm-hmm. And the question that I kept coming back to is how do we introduce this, how do we nurture this mm-hmm. In spite of the fact exactly. that we do have, you know, that these young people are not just looking at their peers, but they're also looking at the adults in their lives.
Exactly.
Who are not necessarily,
yes. And that has an effect.
You know, who
parental
are these?
Norms,
right.
other people. We know that risk opportunity has an effect. So if people are around you, if say you could go either way, and people around you are getting into trouble, hey, let's go down and rob the liquor store. And you just go along, you're carried away because your friends are doing it. You are at higher risk, all factors being equal. So we know, and those kinds of risks have been studied. But we also know that most people who grow up in those areas do not end up in trouble. Most people do not, despite everything. So that's the majority, right? And we know that there are things you can do to change the individual's way of looking at those options that they have in life, framing them differently. And that's what this curriculum is about, to empower the individual with the power of the mind, with the power of the brain, to be able to make a difference and have a different trajectory.
Just to build on Eduardo's point, so what is that allows people who may not have had the benefit of this curriculum yet mm-hmm. to then wind up not going through those risk events?
I mean, and again, there's been a lot of work I'm building on before my work was done. There are some people get lucky. They're not on the corner the day that they decide to, you know, and we all know, I know people like that. Mm-hmm. They just happen to be sick that day when their friends decided to go rob the liquor store and they escape, mm-hmm. right? Or they happen to have an adult that is supervising them. The number of hours of unsupervised time is directly correlated with all kinds of risk taking. So if there's somebody there watching you, monitoring you directly, you're much less likely to get into trouble, and so on. So you add up all these causal factors, plus individual differences, plus the way you think, you get a recipe for either disaster or for a good trajectory. Bob, did you have a question?
Yeah, I'd be really interested. You said the average age was like 15?
15.7 okay, in that particular, and the other one is about 15.5.
Right,
it was high school age, though.
And the majority of the kids in this, the study is ongoing still.
Mike. Well, the 807 was completed.
Right, right.
The 189 is still ongoing.
Okay, the whole group, I'm fascinated with the idea of what are these kids going to be like at 19? The farther they get away from having gone through this experience at 19,
really
they're
question.
Still vulnerable.
Is there possible, as you say, to trap
That's a really
them.
Good question.
Yeah.
That is, you know, and tell NIH, please, because if I could attract, I've thought of that. They would give me money to track them more, I would be delighted and I would do it.
Like the Framingham study or something like
that. Yes, exactly. But I should tell you, one of the reasons we had GIST is for this exact reason. Notice your memory for details does what? Fades. But the GIST is what you retain over time. So when we originally devised this, what I put in the application for the grant money was, we think perhaps this might prevent fade out. Fade out is a common problem with every health and educational intervention, from Head Start all the way up, right? You have this fade out effect. As you get farther away, just as you said, from the initial dose without any re-inoculations, the effect tends to go away. Well, we thought if you base it on GIST, that's what you remember over the long term. So maybe that will allow this, and that's exactly what we showed, that these effects lasted up to a year after they were delivered. And remember, a year in a high school student's life is a longer period of time than it is for us. That's a distinctly, you know, different. Between 15, 16, 16 to 70, that's a long time. And if we can keep them safe while they mature, while they gain that insight, we sort of, while the brain develops, while the tempting stuff becomes less tempting and the self-control goes up, if we can just stave that off, hopefully they'll be in a much better frame of mind to make the right healthy decisions. Jane, did you have?
Yeah, you sort of glossed over the individual differences business. And for example, we all know, I know I was not a risk person.
Mm-hmm.
Although there were things I could point to that were risky that I did. Basically, I thought just my whole life, even as an adolescent. My kids did also. Mm-hmm. My kids would say, what the hell are they doing standing around on the street corner? Well, the kid who was standing around on the street corner was the one who slashed the model. And in an affluent neighborhood of Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. Nothing dangerous about this, just that they were... My sons could not understand what the point was standing around in the street corner.
Mm-hmm.
So they went out and played basketball or whatever.
Yeah.
So what I saw as my kids were growing up were real significant individual differences in just what you're saying, their willingness to take risks, to think beyond, outside the box, as it were.
Yes. Well, you know, that's a good point. And adolescents go, in general, this curvilinear pattern is most kids. Most kids increase their responsiveness to rewards and then decrease. We all like to believe we're completely unique, but actually we're not, right? So there are these group things that account for a lot of behavior. When you add in not only the individual difference, the personality, the responsiveness to reward, and the ability to control yourself, but the environmental things. So risk opportunity is greater in some areas than it is in others. If you're kind of a on-the-fence kid, so you're a little sensation-seeking, you lack a little self-control, but you're not really all that abnormal. But you've got lots of risk opportunity, the cumulative probability. It's just like catching the flu. If you shake hands with a million people who have the flu, the chances of getting the flu are higher. So all of these things combine in a causal fashion. Now, this individual difference, like I said, there's a group of people, but not the majority. This what's called adolescent-dependent risk-taking and then adolescent sort of independent. There's people who, for the rest of their life, are the sensation seekers, lack impulse control, and they account, for example, for the majority of crimes. Most crime is an age-related thing, right? So most taking chances and robbing and getting into trouble and taking substances, which then, of course, increase your chances of getting into trouble, right? All of that goes together. That is a very age-dependent thing. If you can watch the crime statistics rise and fall based on how many young boys there are in the society at any one time. Most people age out of that. They age out of it. There's this group, though, that continues, and they're responsible for a disproportionate amount of this kind of reckless behavior that ruins their lives and ruins other people's lives. But again, I think even with those risk factors, that's why I tell the story of Richard Carmona, because he had all those risk factors, I think. Now, I'm not going to get into any more detail than that, but let's just say, you know, he was in trouble with the law. He admits that. And he ended up Surgeon General. And he still has those characteristics, absolutely. So, I mean, I think it is a question of science. We don't think with human behavior it's a question of science, you know? We think, it's not subject to the laws of nature. Yes, it is. The principles of the scientific method are the same, whether it's the mechanism of the cell or a mechanism of the mind.
So the question I think I really want to ask is, when you have this MRI thing, can you look to see whether there are brain differences or brain reaction differences
exactly
between kids who are more sensation seeking as opposed to more just...
Exactly. That's exactly what we're doing. There's one study, for example, that looked at this. Remember I talked about the reward area, this nucleus accumbens part of the brain? And there's this curvilinear relationship on average, so that younger kids respond less to monetary rewards, like in an experiment. And then adolescents, their accumbens goes bing, bing, bing more, and then it comes down. There's one study linking that to risk-taking behavior. So that's Adriana Galvan's work. And so on. We're following up on that, but we're looking at gist-based intuition and verbatim-based analysis, and we're going to do exactly what you said.
See, I guess what I really want to know is, are some kids really predestined to be in that high sensation-seeking group, just the way Richard Carmona was?
Well, again, predestined, do they have risk factors? Just like you have risk factors for disease, right? But it's not inevitable, necessarily. Nothing is inevitable. And this is my belief, and I base this is partly because of where I came from and the people that I saw and grew up with. But I think the data showed that. You can change the trajectory. You can change. And remember that brain changes a lot. But it's not changing in a vacuum. It's changing as a result of experience. That's what's modeling the brain. The brain is being remodeled based on experience. So that experience, we can have an effect on that experience. But the key thing is to use scientific data. So many people just use what they believe. I have faith in this method. It feels good to me. That's not good enough. It's not good enough for me, and it's certainly not good enough to perpetrate this on young people, right? We must discipline ourselves to use the science. That's probably the most important point I'm going to make, far beyond any importance of in my individual theory or anything. And that is mainly not being done. That's almost all the things we do with young people, including positive youth, all these things that sound so good and probably are effective. We don't test it. We don't demand that it be tested. The public, it's not a matter of course. You know, it's like the old days of medicine before they had clinical trials. That was only the 1940s when those became routine, right? That's recent history. We don't do that in human behavior. We just make it up.
But I think there is more of a focus on using evidence-based
materials,
and there is more of an effort to do that kind of testing of the projects that we're
and
doing.
And Cornell Extension is in the forefront. Yeah.
And I just want to share a real quick story of something that I experienced last week, Tuesday, when I went to visit one of the classes we were doing, a 4-H Youth Voice, Youth Choice, Nutrition and Physical Fitness project. And we were talking with the class about some of the objectives of doing this project, which included helping them make better choices about the foods that they're eating, et cetera. And one of the young ladies in the class raised her hand. She said, Miss. And I said, yes, what's your name? Her name was Brittany. And she says, look, I think you need to be doing this project with elementary school kids, because I'm already 17 years old, and I'm set in my ways. I'm going to be 18 soon, you know. So you just need to do this with younger people, you know. And so we had a whole conversation about that. But, I mean, it was just priceless. I said, so I guess the rest of us might as well just go crawl under a rock.
And see, that's I think at any age people can change. People can change. And this notion that your life's over, you continue to change. People continue to develop across their lives. And that's what the data show, and there's always hope. And we really can change, you know. Someone should tell Brittany.
I told her that, and I told her the story.
But she's right to a large extent. You know
actually,
that.
Well, I told her we were going to use
the data
them.
Show.
But it would really
be a lot easier if we started.
Actually,
them.
It's very counterintuitive. I actually wondered. I went to this workshop thanks to the good old NIH. Thank you, NIH, for educating me. And I met with these people, and I remember this guy sort of going, everybody was saying early experience, intervene early. That's the best thing to do. That's the most effective. It turns out for this behavior, it's not. The data show that if you intervene too early, it's not even relevant. I mean, they're playing with dolls. They're like, what are you talking about condoms? You know, let me play with my dolls, you know. And so it actually is less effective. You have to have that sweet spot of when it's about to be relevant. Yeah.
When I was a kid, I couldn't imagine being older than 18.
Yeah.
I just assumed I'd be dead.
Yeah. What we told Brittany was that we wanted her to learn the information and then go with us to teach the younger youth.
Hey.
So that'll
Excellent.
Give her ultra reinforcement for learning it.
That's
and
a good idea.
Also,
great idea.
They'll listen more to a teenager
That's
than to
correct.
Somebody like
That's
us.
That's a very good idea.
Yeah.
Would it be possible to see some, like a sample of, like, how this information is presented to kids, because you had said that basically you don't want to get into a debate with them because they will defeat you with their logic.
Yes.
All right? And that's completely understandable. So you want to get them to sort of, maybe it's a trick or whatever it is, whatever the method is, sort of come to these conclusions by themselves, by some method, so they're empowering themselves to do this. Because they hate to be told what to do. Okay, but they can also smell when they're being told what to do because they've been told what to do for 15 years.
That's right. That's what we use their values. We don't give them values. Say, you pick which ones are better to you. And it's interesting the kinds of things, you know, that kids really are about. They're about love and sex, and they're about, you know, it's interesting what their actual values are. One example we use is the Russian roulette example. We say, okay, what if I gave you $1 million to play Russian roulette? And here's the gun right here. Would you put it to your head and pull the trigger? And so there's six chambers in the gun and only one bullet, and I'm going to give you $1 million. Now, the odds are with you, right? Now, I don't tell them that. I just say, what would you do? And usually about half of the kids, we use this in our lesson, all right? Because this is actually a paper that I wrote years ago when I said this is the difference in their thinking and our thinking. Half the kids will say, I do it. It's a lot of money, and it's a very low probability. Mm-hmm. And you say, are you kidding? So then you look at the other half, and you go, aha, you're okay, right? They say, no, I want more money. I do it for $1 billion. It's just a question of price. Right. Now, you notice that's the difference between the way we think and the way they think. So I use this example, and we say, every time you have unprotected sex, it's like rolling these bullets in a chamber of a very large gun with only one bullet, maybe 100 chambers, or even fewer than that, but your number is going to come up at some point. And then we do these various kinds of exercises to demonstrate the qualitative nature of this. So we do an exercise. We show that if you have unprotected sex only once a month for a year, at the end of the year, it's about a 1.0 probability that you're pregnant. Because it's 1 out of 12, you do it again, and so on. So it becomes, it's going to happen. You know, it's just a question of when. So rather than worry, okay, this partner is slightly less risky than that partner, I'll have sex with the partner that's less risky. Like, people definitely do this. I remember this, you know. People will say, okay, I'll have sex with a virgin because that way I won't get STDs, and I'll do that. I'll game the system somehow. I'll find my way through the maze, right, of probabilities and risks. We say, don't. You know, it's going to add up. Your number's going to come up. It's just a question of when. It's a very different way of thinking. So we model this sort of qualitative kind of thinking that we're engaging in now, which is almost Greek to the kids. So we model that. And, you know, when we first started this, I thought, I don't know if we can do this. Because how do you get those insights? Experience, right? You see this happen and you go, you know, that's a lot worse than I imagined it to be. This is a deal breaker. I'm just not going to go there. All right, so you develop that. Can we synthesize experience for young people? Is that even possible? And frankly, I really didn't believe we could. But the data are the data. As you could see, outcome after outcome. It's amazing, actually. I do a lot of work on medical decision making as well. And you say to people, so what is the point of your message, your risk message? And people who even deliver the messages don't know the gist. Right? So if they don't know the bottom line, how can we transmit the bottom line? So people are not necessarily focusing on that. They're saying, here's a bunch of facts you have to memorize. This is the effectiveness of a condom. This is the probability of this. This is the base rate of that, right? Memorize. 6 months later, I don't remember. What was that? I didn't even know what a virus was, you know? And you're telling me this, and I'm writing it down verbatim, and I'm memorizing it, and I'm passing the quiz, right? And then my behavior, I'm not making any connection with what's the bottom line. It's just, it's very simple idea, really, our theory. But it really changes the nature of what you try to do in a lesson.